Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Satisfied God Podcast. This is episode number 10, and my name is Raven Bird. Thank you for taking the time to listen. Now, I'm not going to take a lot of time here because, as we said in our last episode, we're going to just pick up where we left off in our last episode, dealing with the end of the law for righteousness to those who believe. As I told you before, I sat down and did a recording for the podcast, and by the time I looked up, I'd almost done a two-hour session. So I've split it up into two parts. But I do ask you, if you are listening to this and you have not listened to part one, cut this off immediately and go to part one, which is episode 9. Go there and listen to that first, because that will lay a foundation that is necessary to be able to at least understand where I'm coming from in this session. So, again, please listen to episode 9 before you listen to this episode. It will help you understand what I'm going to say in this session. Because what we're dealing with, as we dealt with in the previous session, in part one of this, we're looking at the true intention of the law as given and described in Exodus chapter 20. And then we're going to start dealing in this second part, part two, in this session right now, with how Jesus, in his own words, begins to declare the true and more perfect intention of the law. And then we'll take it even further than that in this session to the effect that takes place in the soul that is comprehending the end of the law, the truth of the law. So, without any further delay, let's get right into the session as we ended last time, and we'll just pick up immediately where we left off in the last session. See, this is why Paul describes the law as a schoolmaster unto Christ. It was not a schoolmaster unto Christ's likeness, as if a means of attaining such. It was a schoolmaster unto Christ. It was to bring us to the person of its goal, not to make us imitators of him or make us like him. Why? Because the law was a shadow. The law was a shadow of a substance. A shadow can have only one source and can have only one fulfilling object. And the coming of that one fulfilling object, or let's say it this way, the seeing of that one fulfilling object, to which the shadow ultimately aims, concludes its testimony. But a shadow can have but one source and one substance. If my body casts a shadow, that shadow has one source, and that's me. And there's only one who can fulfill the representation it provides, and that's me. You see this? Not you acting like me, not you laying on the floor trying to fill up my shadow, as we've talked about before. The substance of the shadow was the fulfilling, the ultimate aim and goal of its testimony, the body. Now this is, again, we've read this verse before, Colossians 2. Let no one judge you in eating or in drinking or in respect of a feast or in a new moon or a Sabbath, which are a shadow of the things that then were coming. The body is of Christ. His being is the source of that testimony, and his being is the truth and the goal and the ultimate aim unto which it pointed. If the law was a shadow of what was coming, of the one who was coming, Should not the statements that we have read when God gives the law have but one source, one audience, and one fulfillment? Now remember, we're talking about the knowing of the truth and the liberty of knowing the truth. And I'm telling you, there is no knowledge of the truth as long as you're the object in view, and there is absolutely no liberty as long as you're attempting to become the goal and the aim of the law. Now we'll get to the faith part of this in a moment, because that culminates this reality as far as the soul's realization and apprehension. But I have to focus right now on the absoluteness of this. The absolute that was premised upon Christ, and that Christ is in his eternal being. Whether he is in me or not, he is the absoluteness of this. He is the absoluteness, the fulfilling amen of this, whether he's in me or not. But if he is in you, then the law is fulfilled already in you. Not by you, but in you through the presence of the goal unto which the law pointed. The life that it demanded but could never produce or provide. I mean, the unimaginable horror and condemnation that was caused by ignorance of the singular meaning of the testimony of the law, and that horror still lingers on in the hearts of the majority of believers. The law was a representation of a person, a shadow pointing to a person. But the law was not substance, but the law had one source and one meaning, one ultimate aim, and it was a person. See, that is why the truth cannot be communicated by words or concepts, but must be communicated inwardly by an encounter with the person of the truth. Until that happens, all you have are words and assumptions based upon words, concepts and assumptions and preconceived ideas based upon those things. And I want to take a moment during this time together and just look at this. We know this is Romans chapter 7. Romans chapter 7. This is Paul, and we have to keep in mind, this is Paul not as a Christian who's struggling. Most people have that as a header in their Bibles. This is not Paul talking about himself as a believer, as one who has seen Christ, struggling, trying to be the best Christian he can be and failing miserably because he has some kind of moral deficiency. It's not that at all. He's not describing himself on a roller coaster ride of religion as a Christian. That is absolutely not what he's saying. That's why he speaks in the first verse of this very chapter and says, I'm speaking to you who know the law, because he is going to recount the horror of himself as a zealous Jew under the law and describe the bondage of the law and then the liberty that his soul encountered in the coming of the truth. And we're going to talk about the truth when he sees the end of the law. Not in concepts, but in person and in presence. The liberty that comes in the presence and perfection of another man. So we're seeing here a man who has seen the intention of the law, now recalling and recounting his time under the law. And under the law, Paul was absolutely frustrated and condemned, because what he read in the law, what he knew the law demanded, were just words absent from their substance, absent from their certainty. He was attempting to find the certainty of the words of the law, the demands of the law, in himself. And when we are in that same situation in our ignorance, in our religious zeal, without the knowledge that comes in the face of Jesus Christ, the immediate inclination is to apply the words of the law, the words of the testimony to ourselves, and attempt to find and evidence their certainty in our adherence to those words and our fulfilling of the requirements that they give. But the requirement of the law was not fulfilled by our deeds and was never intended to be so. The fulfillment of the requirement of the law was the life of the one that was declared by it and testified in it. Condemnation was never the intention of the law. It was to drive a heart that was under its covering to the life that it demanded and the life of which it spoke. Its truth, its fulfillment, its end. So now I want to go on with you here and talk to you about this struggle in Romans 7. I'm going to read some verses to you. Verse 10. The commandment which was ordained unto life, I found to be death, or to be unto death, or I found death. I found death in a commandment that was ordained to life. What does that mean? That is so vital. That spells out Exodus 20 and what we have said about it. It spells it out in just one beautiful statement. The commandment, the law, was unto life. Do you see that? It was unto life. It was not unto condemnation. It was not unto death. It did not have that as its intended goal. The intention of the law was life. Most people, when they teach about the law, they condemn it like it was a big old axe hammer that God hit people over the head with. The law was a testimony of Christ. The law was ordained, given of God, divinely intended unto life. But it was not your life. The intention of the law was not you. Not your life better, your life holy, your life righteous. And that is why when he put his life up against the law that demanded the life of another, death was found. He found it to be death unto himself. It exposed who he was because it was a declaration of another, not Paul, but Christ. See that? That is why Paul came to the end of the law in the seeing of Christ and can declare in beauty and liberty and glorious faith, it is not I, but Christ who lives in me. See, that's the law fulfilled in Paul. That is a man whose soul is recognizing and has recognized the law in its perfection. The law and the goal and the intention of the law, not as a principle to be fulfilled, but as a presence and a person being revealed. This was always the aim. This was always the goal. So let's go on. For sin, I can stop in all of these verses and I probably will. We may cut this in half. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. Now let's stop there for a second. Now this is a man, again, under the law. We're talking about the end of the law is Christ. But Paul, being ignorant of Christ as the end, while he's under the law, under this system, attempted to become its end by zealous works and deeds of religion, what he believed the law demanded. Sin, taking an occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. What does that mean? slavery to sin. Now again, take this back to John 8 when Jesus is exposing the true bondage. The true bondage he's speaking of in John 8 is not external bondages, but is an inward bondage. An inward bondage to sin. Sin, not that we commit, but the inward sin, the sin that we are. So he's reading the law, the commandments, and sin takes an occasion in those commandments and deceives Paul. This is what happens on a daily basis in the heart of most Christians. And this very thing that Paul's referring to here is the very thing that's preached from pulpits as the requirement given of God. And all it is sin taking an occasion and deceiving us all. What does that mean? Paul will refer, let's read another verse here. I'm going to, let's go back to that verse, but let's read these verses here, okay? Verse 12. This is after he says, the law took occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. Wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just and good. Was then that which is good made death unto me? God forbid. But sin, that it might appear sin, working death in me by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. And this is important too. We'll look at that. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that I do not. But what I hate, that do I. If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Do you see that? If then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Meaning, if I am exposed in the presence of the good of the law as the very contradiction to it, then I am verifying and consenting that the law is good and I'm evil. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. Again, John 8, the sin that they're bound to. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing. For to will is present, but how to perform it or bring it into completion, I find not. Why? Because you'll never find it in yourself. It was never intended to be found in you. It was always about another. It was always the testimony of the law itself was not about you not doing it. It was a declaration of him who cannot do it because it's not who he is. It's not his nature. It's not his kind. It's not his character. It's not in his being. You or and I are everything contrary to who he is. I want you to see this. For the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not is what I do. Now again, just keep in mind that he is saying all of this up against the law, in reference to the law. So when he says the good and the evil, he's talking about the good of the law and the evil that is made evident as who I am when I am up against, when I put myself up against the law. I am exposed as the contradiction to its true intention. I find then a law. Now here's what we're going to get to. I find then a law that when I would do good, evil is still present with me. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man, but I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into the captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members, O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? My, what a declaration of frustration it is. And this is the frustration that I know most Christians live under, because I was one. But I was one ignorant of the end of the law for righteousness. The end of the law that came and is now made unto me the righteousness the law demanded. And this is what we're talking about. So there is now presented by Paul here a law of sin and death that is in our members. It is not the law of Moses. The law of sin and death in our members is not the law of Moses. Remember, the law of Moses he presents as good and spiritual. But the law of sin and death is another law altogether that is contrary to the intention of the law of Moses. The law that is in our members is sin, death. It's who we are by nature. It's a governing principle in our very being that does what? That makes it an absolute impossibility for us to do or perform the good that the law demands, because the good that the law demands is not in us. Remember, no good in me. This is a man seeing that the law is, it has to be a testimony of someone else, because if I'm honest, that cannot be talking about me. That I am never going to be that righteous. I could never be that good. I can never be that holy. And you're going to see in a moment, Jesus is going to expose that even further in his own words. But there's beautiful reality and liberty that comes in it. So now understanding this law in his members, the law of sin, the law of sin and death in his very members, in himself, the law that governs his being, making it impossible for him to perform or to fulfill the intended goal of a law that speaks of another who by nature is contradictory to everything we are. Diametrically opposed. That, again, that's why he says, O wretched man that I am, not just bad things I do, and if I stop doing those bad things, I won't be wretched. No, he sees the whole matter. He sees there is no hope for this man. I am a wretched man. Wretched man I am, and what will deliver me or bring deliverance, bring liberty from this body of death? The body of death is a body that is void of the life that can only fulfill the law. A body full of deeds and zealous actions, but void of the life that is the goal and aim of those demands. And I'm saying, if you're not born again, you are void of that life. But you can have that life as one who is born again and still live in ignorance of him and still live in bondage to religion, because you believe righteousness is an achievement and not a person who has been presented, provided, given to your soul as the end of the matter. Now, let's just go back to these verses. Sin, that it might appear sin, working death in me by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. What is that saying? Basically, in a nutshell, in one little statement, Paul is being presented in the law under its bondage and the frustration and condemnation he's constantly under. He is realizing, because the law does expose this, the law exposes there's no help for you. There is no hope in this man at all. No help in me. No help. And the law and its demands is not an attempt to help me be better. It is to bring my soul to the better one. So this takes us back to his statement that sin, took an occasion by the law or the commandment and deceived him and slew him. What's that mean? The sin that is working in him, the sin that governs his members and his being, the sin that he is, looked at the law and took that occasion to say, you know what? I can do that. Remember what Israel said. Remember what the people said after God gave them the law and all of those things. Remember what they said when he began to tell them different commandments and different things. They said, everything he says, we're going to do it. Everything he says, we'll do. And there is an instance where they say that, and then he tells the priest, he said, now take the blood of the sacrifice and put half of the blood on the altar, and then you sprinkle the rest of the blood on these people. Now, this was immediately after they said, everything he says, we'll do it. Every command he gives, we'll do it. And he says, now, sprinkle them with the blood that has touched the altar. Why? Because God understood. The testimony presented there is that if the command and the law is to be done, performed, brought to its fullness, then it will be brought to its fullness in the comprehension, not I, but Christ. I am dead and he lives. The altar must be associated with if the performing of the law is ever going to be a realization. I have to see I am dead and he who is the fullness, the end, the goal, the intention, the life of the law's demand is now my life unto God. That's the realization that must govern my heart, and that's when the law is known to be fulfilled in me. The law is fulfilled in me because he's present in me, but the law is only realized and acknowledged as fulfilled in me when I see him who is in me. Verse 11 again. The sin that was in him, the governing principle of sin and death that was in his members, looked at the words of the commandments, looked at the law and said, I can do that. I can be holy. I can be righteous. I can be perfect. And in all of that lust that was in him toward good, toward righteousness, this is not a man lusting after women or lusting after drugs. This is a man lusting after God and holiness and righteousness, but lusting after it in himself, attempting to become and to be and to achieve that end, instead of pursuing Christ as the end. So the sin in him took the occasion of the law and said, I will be that. I will do that. And that's what Jesus comes to when he says, your fathers have made the word of God of none effect. You have made these traditions and you've done. You see what they did? They were deceived by the sin that was in them. Looking at a spiritual law, a law that had a spiritual intent and a spiritual goal in view, and trying to apply that spiritual law to natural man. And they were deceived by it. But the deception exposed at some point in time in the heart of Paul, it showed that he was not capable of being what he assumed or that sin had promised him he could be. He was not able to produce the righteousness of the law. He was not able to bring it into being or to fulfill that requirement. Why? Because he was void of the life. And he was trying to seek it apart from the life of which the law testified. That's what it means. It exposed him as dead, exposed him as void of the life the law demanded. He lived in that deception until his soul saw the end of the law. And in the seeing of the end of the law, the righteousness of God could finally be realized because it was being realized in the presence of another man and not in the wretched man that Paul is. See that? This is the basis of all spiritual deception. The lust that brings that deception is to attempt to fulfill a law that was never about you, to fill a shadow that was never cast by your body. That is the basis of all spiritual deception. It was not the law that deceived Paul. It was the sin that was in him that deceived him. Sin deceived him into the assumption and the attempting to be the intention of its demand. And this brings bondage to the body of death, the body that is governed by a law of sin and death. A man, the Adamic man, governed by sin, bound to sin, bound to himself. See, this is the very thing Paul says in Galatians 5:17. He says that the spirit and flesh will not work together. The flesh lusts against the spirit lusts against the flesh. They are contrary to one another. They are at war, at enmity against one another, so that the thing that you desire to do, you cannot do or bring to fruition or bring to accomplishment. What did Paul desire to do? The same thing he's talking about here in Galatians. What he desired to do was be righteous, separate from the life of the one righteousness of God, separate from the person who was the righteousness described in the law. He was trying to be that, to do it, to perform it. And he was trying to get the flesh and the spirit to cooperate to bring about such a desired end. But the flesh desires one end, and the spirit desires another. The spirit has seen and knows and would reveal in your soul another end, the true goal. As your flesh lusts after the goal that has you as its center and you as its substance, the Spirit of God, in contradiction to that deception, will reveal in you the true end. The true end found in the being, in the presence of the indwelling Christ. Now, we take this further. Matthew chapter 5. Again, we're still going in all of these places in reference to Exodus 20. And who is the true intention of the law? To whom was God speaking? Who was the reference point when God was declaring, thou shalt not, or as we have seen in the literal, you do not, you do not. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. This is very important. This is in the context of what we call the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus begins to speak here in verse 17. Think not, do not assume that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And the reference in my Bible is Romans 10:4, what we've been reading, him as the end of the law for righteousness. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. I came to fulfill the law. Now, we won't get into verse 18 at this point. But verse 17, I did not come to destroy the law. I'm come to fulfill it. What this means is I am not here to dissolve the law and prove that it was always insignificant. To just bring it to non-existence, So you don't have to be bothered by the stringent requirements of that law again. That I came to do that. No. I came as the full intent, meaning the determined purpose of the law. I am come. I've said it before. He is not saying it was insignificant. He is saying it was insufficient. The sufficiency of it is me in my presence, me in my coming. You understand? And I refer this back to the Queen of Sheba and her encounter with King Solomon again, when she says, "I heard the report, but I didn't know half of it. You exceed their words." And the word "exceed" there means to add to. What did he add to the words? He added substance. He added fullness. He fulfilled the intention of their testimony. And that's what Jesus has come to do. That's what he came here and says he's come to do. I'm not saying their testimony's invalid. I am saying my life and presence is the true validation of the words. And as that, in his coming, he has brought the law. This is beautiful. This is refers to what we've said. He brought the law from its inapprehensible form and words and concepts that were a shadow. And he brings in and as himself spiritual substance, eternal intention, the righteousness described within the framework of that law. He brings all of that in himself, and he brings it in its most apprehensible form, in and as himself. It was not now the representation of the good things. It was not just merely intimating that there was something real, something true. No, we're talking about the real thing, the person who cast the shadow. Now in an apprehensible form, being come. Now we understand this points to the true apprehensible form of spirit where he dwells in us as the fullness of the law, as the fulfillment that we've already talked about earlier. And this is going to be, this apprehensible form is going to become more significant when we read it in Philippians 3 and what Paul says, having come from the struggle, and we'll go to that, having come from the struggle of Romans 7 under the law, now coming to the true liberty of knowing a law in its perfect fulfillment, embodied in the person of Christ and not in himself. Now, let's go on. We're still in Matthew 5. Verse 20, "For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed," there's the word again, very important, "shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees." Where did their righteousness reside? Where was their assumed righteousness found? In the law. "Your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, or you will in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard it was said of them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Verse 27, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." Now again, notice again, this is all in the context and prefaced upon the statement, "I am come to fulfill the law." So is he presenting to them some stringent requirement that they are left to achieve or to fulfill? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
See, most people have read this and they have interpreted these words with that type of interpretation. They have believed that here Jesus has come and begins to declare to them a more stringent law than the law of Moses. So now most people will say, see, now under the new covenant, not only are your external activities to be restrained, you can't even think the thought or you're going straight to hell. And if that were true, ladies and gentlemen, we're all in bad, bad trouble. You remember? Who among you are without sin, let him cast the first stone. They were all sensible enough to walk away. Paul says that the fathers were unable to keep the law. They were unable to keep that yoke. They couldn't fulfill it. At their best, Paul, being a man blameless under the law, blameless under its stringent requirements and deeds and obediences that it required, was perfect in that form, but still declares what we've read in Romans 7, wretched man that I am. This is Jesus coming not to put upon man the stringent requirements of a law that's more stringent than Moses, or even saying this is what Moses meant. It's worse than you thought. No, he is coming and presenting himself as the full intention of what we have already read in Exodus, the things he quotes here in these verses. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not. And he's saying, you've applied that to yourself. And I'm saying that the true meaning of this was not just about externalities of actions and activities. It was about who you are in nature. It's about a nature, a life. And I'm telling you, it was not your life that it declared. It didn't testify of your life and what it had the potential to be. It declared a righteousness that exceeds that righteousness that the Pharisees and the scribes have adapted and adopted. A righteousness that, although testifies of me, has been brought down into the earth and applied to man, and now man assumes he has a righteousness before God. You understand? He's showing them that it was not the deeds done or not done that fulfills the law, or that is the exceeding righteousness. It was always about a life that they were never able to produce, a nature that was not found in them. Remember what Paul said in Romans 7? How to perform it. I desire to be holy. I desire to be righteous. I desire to fulfill the good presented by the law. But how to perform it or to achieve it fully, I do not find in myself. No, you won't, because it was never a testimony about you. And that's what Jesus is showing here. He is making it evidently clear. And he is proving that the fulfillment of the law was never intended or expected to be found in the Adamic man, but in another man, who by his living, his residence within them, would be in every man what they are not and could never be. That is the righteousness that exceeds a righteousness that those who believe in an external righteousness assume they have. Because that's truly not righteousness at all.
The righteousness the law describes is realized in the life it describes. And this is what he's saying. It's not, oh, it's much worse than you thought. He's saying it was never about you. And if you are going to come to the righteousness that it truly intended, that it the righteousness unto which it truly pointed, you must come to me, because it was always about who I am. I am the fulfillment of the law. See that? He stands there as the substance of Exodus 20, because he stands there as the intended audience, source, and substantiation of what we read in Exodus 20. The life it declared, who he was not. He does not do these things because it's not in his nature. It's not who he is. That's who you are. And it's who you always will be. But see, that's why the blood had to touch the altar and touch the people when they said, everything God says, we'll do it. Because he knew you couldn't do it. That's why the cross put away the man who could never be or perform, leaving one life. And that if the performing of the law, the doing of the law, the righteousness of the law is to be accomplished at all, it must be accomplished in the presence of the person who is the life it demands, which leaves one thing, and that is the knowing of that life. I'm just touching that very, very, we could go in into a lot of areas in that, and I don't really think we should at this moment. But now I want to go a little further as we end this. And we see this as an inward reckoning, an inward reality due to his presence, an inward reckoning due to the presence being revealed, made known. The true intention of the law was always about a life that is now given to the soul. It was always about a life, a man, whether he's in me or not. He was always the intended goal, the aim of his testimony. But now, by the grace of God, he lives in you. And in his presence has brought the end, the perfection, into your soul, into my soul. And that is why Christ being revealed is the vital matter for believers. Because without the soul experiencing the life that has been given, we'll always attempt to make spiritual things something we accomplish. The revelation of Christ inwardly is not the law fulfilled. The law fulfilled in us is the presence of the person. The inward revealing of Christ is when the fulfilled law is fully known and experienced in the person of Christ and not in ourselves. Now, Philippians chapter 3. And this is a man now who has come to this true encounter, and he with the end of the law. Let me turn there for a second. Philippians chapter 3. And I can say that because of this one thing. I can say that based upon these statements. You can say that anyway, but let me base it upon one thing that's very important. Verse 1 of chapter 3 in Philippians. Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things to you, to me, is not grievous, but for you it is safe. Verse 2 here. Listen to this carefully. Beware of dogs. Beware of evil workers. Beware of the concision. Now, what does concision mean? I always read over that for years, and I thought it was just circumcision. The Jews who would try to turn them back to Judaism. And it is that, but he uses this word concision
for a very specific reason. Now remember, he's going to talk about himself under the law in a moment, but he prefaces it with calling these Jews, the Judaizers, the concision. The word concision refers to those who are circumcised, but it refers to them in a very pointed way, because the word concision actually means mutilators, those who mutilate themselves. Now you see, I want you to understand this. This is a man who at one time boasted in the fact that he was circumcised. And he's going to say here that he was circumcised on the eighth day as a Jew. But now there has been a true comprehension of a consummation that has come, that has brought about an understanding in his heart that those things are no longer valid. And not only that, but to keep doing those things is not now a sign of righteousness or covenant. Now it's mutilation. You are mutilating yourselves. Man, that's quite a change. What brought about such an inward transition? Because those things were still happening during this time. The temple was still there, sacrifices, people were still being circumcised. The Jews were still converting people to it and circumcising them. And he says it's mutilation. Well, here's how that transition come about. And he's saying, I can have confidence in the flesh more than any of you, because I was a zealous Jew, touching the righteousness of the law, blameless. If I was to trust in the flesh, my dear brothers, I'm the one that has all right to do so. But I've seen a greater reality, and my confidence and trust is in another. Remember, for righteousness to those who believe. We're still on that. The end of the law for righteousness to those who believe. It's the very thing upon which your confidence is set. The comprehension of your heart is set, not on the outward. Because he says, we're the circumcision that worship God in spirit and worship and have no confidence in the flesh. Our confidence is found in another. Our confidence is not found in fleshly circumcision. Our confidence is found in the circumcision that we have found in the spiritual realization of Christ, in the realization of its spiritual intent. So here's the transition. Here's where it comes. Verse 7. What things were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and do count them but dung, that I may win Christ, and be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is of the law. Remember, Matthew 5, that your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. Here's a Pharisee of Pharisees at one time who boasted in that position. Now, having come in the excellency of the knowledge of Christ, in the encounter with the person of the righteousness of God himself, he has come to the exceeding righteousness. Where he once boasted in the righteousness that was of the law, that he assumed he possessed under the law, now, having seen the goal and intent of the law, he realized it was never about Paul. It was always pointing to this one, to this man of excellence, to this man that exceeds all thing in that he is their spiritual fullness and intended end. Now he says, not having my own righteousness, a righteousness defined by me, measured in me. That's what my own means. A righteousness defined in me, measured by me, that looks just like me. And that righteousness is of the law.
But see, it was never the righteousness intended or described by the law. It was the righteousness that they assumed the law gave to them. But having seen Christ now, he understands that the only righteousness that he truly, if righteousness is to be a result at all, or experienced at all, could not be by the law, but it must be by him who is the end of it. And in faith, receiving him as the goal of the law's intent, the meaning, the life of which it spoke. The righteousness which is of God by faith. This again fulfills Romans 10. This now again goes back to Romans 10. To everyone, he is the fulfillment of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. That is what Paul is speaking of as the righteousness of God by faith. It's the same thing. The word believes here in Romans 10:4 is the verb form of the noun faith. It is not just about righteousness being the result of believing in Jesus. It's about faith, beholding the person of spiritual reality, beholding him as the end of the law, as the righteousness that was always intended but could never be produced by my labor or my zeal. See? Righteousness is finally realized in the seeing of the end, in the seeing of the truth of its intention. So Paul would say, I have counted loss all of these things. He's not forsaking circumcision. He is forsaking circumcision that is not defined in the person of Christ. He's not forsaking righteousness. He's forsaking a righteousness that is not defined in the face and presence of Christ. You understand? He's counting as loss what never was real. Because now his soul has seen truth. His soul has seen that the intention of the whole thing, the intention of God, has always been Christ and not Paul. So he can relinquish his hold and his boast in those things that were centered, defined, and measured in the presence of Paul, because he has seen all things defined, measured, amened, and concluded in the presence of the person of Jesus Christ in him. And this is the very thing he sees in Romans 8. And the thing that brings his soul from the bondage of applying a spiritual law to a natural man, to the liberty of seeing the life of another in which the law and by which the law is perfectly fulfilled. Here's Romans 8, 1 through 4. There is then now no condemnation to those in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ did set me free, here's the liberty, from the law of sin and death. That's the law that's in me. That's not the law of Moses. He fulfilled the law of Moses. He set my soul free from the law of sin and death. For what the law was not able to do, in that it was weak through the flesh, God, his own Son, having sin in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, did condemn the sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law may be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Notice this. What the law could not do. The weakness of the law was you. You were not its intended aim or its goal. It's not that you didn't work hard enough. It's that it was never possible for you to achieve the end of the law's intention. You were never its intention.
As long as you are the object in view, this is why he's freed me from the law of sin and death. That's freed me from beholding myself and trying to see in myself what can only be seen in and as him. As long as you're the goal, as long as you're the object, the law remains unfulfilled and the righteousness it describes remains as an unachieved goal. When it is not you but Christ, he put away everything you are. He brought that to the cross. He condemned sin in the flesh. That means he put away the man of sin, the man who was contradictory to the intention of the law. He put that man away. He put you, he put me away by the cross so that he may live in the soul as everything of spiritual reality in its consummated, apprehensible form. Paul would go on in Philippians 3 and say, I desire to apprehend that for which I am apprehended now, because righteousness is no longer in an abstract form depending on Paul. Now it's in a spiritual substance and substantial form in Paul, that he may apprehend him as everything he at one time desired to become. When the perspective of your heart has been brought from you to Christ, your soul has been delivered. You are being, have been, and are now being sanctified in the truth. You see righteousness not left for your achievement, but fully achieved in him and provided as him to your soul. Thus the soul is brought from the deception of sin to the liberty of knowing a law in spiritual fulfillment. And to me, this is the grand meaning of the phrase that we have in John chapter 1, that the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came in Christ. These two things are connected for a reason, the law given by Moses and grace and truth coming in Christ. They're connected for a reason. And it always, and it has to do with this statement in John, of his fullness have we all received. And it has to do with the end of the law being come, the end of the law coming, the intention of his writings. Grace and truth came and is set in juxtaposition to the law that was given by Moses. Why? It's because the coming of grace and truth is a substantiation and the fulfilling of all that the law intended when it was given by Moses. Truth is what we have said. Truth is the person, the body, the substance that is the eternal predicate and basis and validity of every jot and tittle of the testimony. Everything God ever said, everything God ever intended, he's the substance, the truth of it. But grace, and that's why grace and truth, those two things being joined together, it's so significant up against the law. Because grace is the fact that that one who is the eternal substance, that one spoken of as the Word who is with God, was God, in the beginning with God, and is the source of God's creation, everything he did, and without him nothing was made that was made. That one, the grace of God is that that one, the truth himself, in his fullness, now resides in your soul. And is by his very being in presence the fulfilling of the law and its intention. May the Father reveal his Son. May our soul come to know in the presence of the truth the end of the law, so that righteousness can now no longer in our hearts and our comprehension be some unachieved and almost unattainable thing, but be comprehended by the life that God by his grace
has provided to the soul. Therein our posture, the posture of our heart, the motivation and purpose of our soul will be from that realization onward. From the moment that realization dawns in our hearts onward, the desire and pursuit will be to know and to apprehend who He is, to apprehend the person of the truth. All right, thank you. We're going to stop there. I just want you to understand that my desire in all of these sessions that we have together and all of this, and my reason for doing that, is so that your soul, my soul, will become intimately acquainted with the end and no longer desire to see in ourselves what can never be seen outside of the person and presence of Jesus Christ. And our soul will be liberated, freed, sanctified in truth by the appearing of the truth, and our soul knowing Him. So, we will stop there. Thanks again for all your time. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And again, please tell other people about it. People that you know are on iTunes. Hey, tell them about the podcast now being on iTunes. They can just pull it right up and subscribe to it. I just love this form of communication. I appreciate you communicating with me. And now may the Father reveal His Son, flood our hearts with His light, that in that light, in the light of His presence, we may truly know and experience the greatness, the fullness of our great salvation. Until next time, thanks for listening.